Hello, I am Paige Alviniak, editorial director at Promax, and this is the Daily Brief podcast. Today, I am joined by Alberto Orihuela. He is co-founder and CMO of Fubo TV. Hello, Alberto, and welcome.
Hey, how's it going?
It's going great. How are you?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. All right, so why don't you kick it off by telling me and our audience what Fubo TV is, how it started, and what it has evolved into today?
Yeah, so Fubo TV, it's essentially a cable replacement service. In basic terms, if you pay for cable and you've been used to kind of all the traditional stuff with cable, you get your hundreds of channels, your DVR, and so on. You can get that with Fubo TV for much less of a price, actually probably about half of the price of cable. And, you know, essentially we have over 100 channels, mostly on the sports side of things. And you can access the service anywhere you are, from your phone, computer, Apple TV, Roku, Fire TV, and so on. So essentially, it's a great solution for people who want to save money on cable and just cut the cord.
How much is it, or how much are the packages?
So it starts at $55, and we also have a product for U.S. Hispanics, which is called Fubo Latino, which starts at $20.
Okay. And then it starts at $55, and then you can add on premium networks, essentially?
That's right. So if you want to add Showtime or premium features like 500 hours of recording for DVR or this thing called Family Share that allows you to watch for multiple streams at the same time, then you can add those to your basic subscription. Or if you want to add Red Zone, for example, it's another one of the premium add-ons.
Okay. And then, so if I get Fubo TV and I have a, a smart TV with Roku, I could get Fubo TV and then I could get HBO Max and I could get Netflix or however I want to put that together.
That's right. Well, HBO Max and Netflix, you have to get as an additional service, not included within Fubo TV.
Right.
Yeah, Showtime is kind of the only one that we currently offer right now. But yeah, you will be able to tag it on with all those services.
But you could add on your own, essentially.
Exactly.
And then you guys have programming agreements with networks, so there's advertising.
There is advertising, yep. So it's much like a traditional linear channel, right?
Right.
So, you know, there will be the ad break in the middle. Also, our VOD library might often have ads included in there. So it's not unlike cable from that point of view, where you're watching Discovery Channel and you might have an ad break in, you know, between segments here and there.
So when you guys go to like a Discovery Channel, that's a good example, and you're saying we're going to launch Fubo TV and it's going to be a cable replacement service. How difficult is it at this point to get those program providers to sign on? Are they at this point like, we're bringing our programming to wherever we can so that anybody can get it? Like, what was that process like?
So at this point, it's actually pretty easy. It was really hard at the beginning. So about 5 years ago, we launched Fubo, and it was basically three of us in an apartment living room. And, you know, we got together with this kind of idea of thinking, hey, it looks like there is a shortage of way. Initially, Fubo started as a soccer streaming service. So we thought that there seems to be a shortage of ways of watching live soccer online. And clearly, you can get it through cable, but for people that are cutting the cord, there's just not very many ways of getting it. So we kind of sat there and said, okay, so how do we go about getting the right to this content? And, well, you saw Being Sports has it, Gold TV had some, ESPN had some, and you know, the three of us, naive at the time, we thought, let's just call them and say, hey, we're launching a new service, we want to have your channel on the product. And I remember we called ESPN when we had 27 subs, and we said, guys, we want to do a deal with you. We are Fubo TV. And they're like, what, Fubo? Like, what is that? And as you can imagine, there is a credibility hit that when you're starting out from a living room doesn't play out so well. We didn't have a known brand or kind of a backing that was known in the marketplace. So those were some really tough conversations in the early days. And frankly, props go to my co-founder, David, who basically knocked through walls to get our early stage deals. You know, one of the first deals we got was with beIN Sports, which is a mid-sized sports channel that curates to soccer fans. And I remember he essentially emailed beIN Sports for about 2 weeks nonstop and said, I happen to be in Miami today, and I'd love to be able to come by and tell you about Fubo. And every other day he was in Miami. He was actually here in New York, but he was just waiting for that window, and he flew immediately down to Miami, and he pitched beIN Sports on this idea that their content should be on the web. You know, it's right now on traditional pay TV channels, but you can't get it digitally, and that is missing on a massive opportunity of consumers that are cutting the cord or, you know, tired of cable, and they should be able to get that content. So BeIn was one of the first channels that we were able to add on the back of that promise, and we certainly overpaid for every piece of programming when we first got started, just because people were not giving us the time of day. I remember our first deal with NBC, we told them, we just name the number, we'll pay whatever it is that you're asking for, because we believe in the model, and there is a shift in the way that consumers are consuming this sort of content, and it's all going digital, and we could be one of the first services to offer that. So we're ready to pay premium rates above what the cable guys are paying, just because we thought, okay, this is really going to be revolutionary, and we have to be playing in this market. So over the next, essentially the first year, Fubo evolved from what was traditionally kind of a soccer niche-centric product to kind of a multi-sport cable replacement service. And this was where it coincided, and frankly, largely by luck, with this massive cord-cutting wave where folks were just, you know, fed up with the traditional ways of cable, rising prices, poor customer care, poor mobility. And the, what our category was called the virtual MVPDs started to come into the market and essentially say, guys, it doesn't have to be that way anymore. We're going to give you the same experience with cable, but it's going to be better and it's going to be cheaper. And that is kind of a, you know, a great value proposition for people that are willing to take that leap of faith.
Did you, when you guys were first doing this, A, when you were agreeing to these, to the licensing fees, how were you financing it, and how freaked out were you?
How were we financing? Right, we were pretty freaked out.
yeah, it's very brave.
So we raised. Well, you know, think about this. We all quit our jobs, and we thought that we could do this, which the odds were not in our favor. If you think about how hard it is to make a name in the media space without, you know, the backings of a major conglomerate. If you think about all of our competitors right now, YouTube TV, Hulu Live, PlayStation View, which is shutting down soon, DirecTV Now, or AT&T TV, any variation of those names, and Sling, they're all backed by major conglomerates and media companies that have virtually unlimited budgets to spend on these projects. And in the case of Fubo, that was not the case. We raised a very small seed investment in the early days from one single investor, and essentially it was a chance for us to validate the fact that we could deliver a service and build basic technology around that. And once we could show a proof of concept and show that we were growing in terms of customer acquisition and quality of experience, the plan was to go back to the market and raise again. And we were lucky in that at every single point we were able to hit our milestones in terms of growth and performance, and you know, we were able to raise from investors, both strategics and financial. So, but in the early stages, I mean, it was a very nimble budget. Like literally the first month, I think we got 27 subscribers, and we were celebrating like, oh my God, we got real people paying for this product. our tech was running out of a cable box in our living room apartment. So you can picture that was not very reliable, and, you know, over the my Wi-Fi internet service. And you know, certainly very clunky in the early days. But one of the amazing things that you realize is, like, when you're bringing a new product to the market that consumers are really hungry for, they're gonna give you a chance. And I can't tell you how many times our video broke in those early days. We would start a game 15 minutes into it. It would fall off right before that goal. And consumers, as you can imagine, were incredibly frustrated with that experience. But because we were trying to do something that was different and new and hadn't been done before, and they really wanted it, they were so forgiving, right? So we had the virtue and, I guess, the opportunity to be in a market where our consumers are loyal and fun. And you know, willing to let a startup like ours make so many mistakes in the way and still give us a chance. So, it's been incredible.
So when you guys started, I know you said this, you started as sort of a way to provide people with soccer, and then you had BeIn as one of your first programmers. But I feel like when you look at the Fubo lineup today, it's still got quite a bit more sports, I think, than the traditional virtual MVPD. Do you feel like sports is kind of your unique differentiating point for the marketplace?
Yeah, I think it's not a surprise, and I think probably all of our competitors realizes that sports and news are the two single most important pieces of content when it comes to traditional cable viewers, right? And if you think about the folks that are cutting the cord early on right now, that kind of like first, call it 10 to 15% of folks that will ultimately cut the cord, they're doing so because in many ways they're just tired of cable, and they think that they can get the same content elsewhere. And often they're not necessarily heavy sports fans, right? But there's a lot of them in there. But the people that are really hardcore sports fans, they're still staying with cable. And the reason for it is because sports and news is what drives the bundle, is what drives the desire to pay for these crazy, average cable bill. I think it's about $110 nationally. So you're willing to pay that every month just because you have that loyalty towards your teams, and you want to get that content. So for us, as we're thinking about how the market is going to evolve over time, the early folks that are cutting the cord, only 40% of them are buying a virtual MVPD, right? So a product like Fubo. The rest of them are either not buying anything at all, or just buying the Netflix or the Hulu Lives of the world, or the HBO Goes and whatnot. So that is going to change. The moment that the people that are sitting on the cable bundle realize that they can still get their teams and their games through a virtual provider that is half of the cost they're paying, that's going to be a pretty transformative time for our industry, and you're going to start to see that kind of second phase. Right now, you have the early adopters cutting the cord, and kind of the folks that are willing to be tech savvy and take a leap of faith. Very soon, as soon as the technology becomes basically it's very simple and not intimidating, right? Because it's a challenge to say, hey, I can just flip the channel and I can watch television, but now you require me to get a connected device, and I have to download this app, and it's a little more complicated for folks. But the moment that they see that it's actually not that hard, you're going to see a transformative shift where essentially folks are going to start cutting the cord because it's better than cable, and that cohort is going to be largely sports viewing. So it's a really a roundabout way to saying we want to be a product that is curated to the entire household, but at the same time, we are sports first. So we really are going after sports fans and their families, because we think that's really what drives the pay TV bundle.
So sports are known to be difficult, well, especially, like NFL rights are very exclusive, expensive, et cetera. You guys have kind of gone around that with things like soccer, different kinds of rights. But, as more and more people get into this marketplace, how are you finding it is in terms of acquiring and keeping access to these sports networks?
As a startup, we can't afford to go and buy NFL rights. That's just that would
No
be
one can.
prohibitive, to say the least.
Yeah.
Good luck, Amazon. But at the same time, we don't have to, because we're able to work with these distributors that are getting the rights themselves, right? So, and the same in the case of soccer, right? Like, we don't have to go and acquire the Liga rights or Champions League rights. We can work with the folks that are acquiring and redistributing them. And because we have confidence in our ability to execute and get subscribers, we don't really have the need for exclusivity, right? We would only go after exclusive rights if we felt like, look, we don't have an edge in user acquisition, or we're kind of getting crushed by the competition with massive budgets, and thereby a better investment of capital will be to go and acquire rights directly as opposed to invest that into user acquisition. And that hasn't been the case since we launched. We're still very competitive relative to the others in the market. In fact, I'll brag that I think our subscriber acquisition cost is probably by far the lowest relative to others. But we can do so because, we are comfortable with competing. But no, in this case, we would be essentially working with the Foxes, NBCs of the world, CBS, if you will, to bring in the content. We wouldn't go directly.
But as they start to launch their own services, do you feel like they would restrict access to some of this programming to keep it for themselves, or do you feel like the marketplace will still re will remain open?
Yeah. I mean, it's happened already. I think if you look at NBC Gold Pass, some of the content is exclusive only to that platform, but not to others. And consumers, that's challenging. As far as it happening with kind of the prime programming like NFL, it's a little bit arguably the traditional business that these companies have developed with the MVPDs would be largely put at risk if they all of a sudden put premium rights that they bought only on their direct-to-consumer services and not on their linear channel, right? So if I am CBS and I'm working with Dish Network and all of a sudden I take NFL from the linear feed and only pull it in CBS All Access, Dish is going to have a huge issue with that. I mean, forget about us. We're the small guys. We don't have a lot of leverage. But the others, they do have a lot of leverage, and that's going to be a tough conversation to be had. So they're right now, they're walking the line and trying to figure it out, how far can I push it on my direct-to-consumer business without completely destroying the value that my distribution business has with all these distributors, right?
So actually so working in your favor, maybe, is that – sorry, just maybe working in your favor that NFL rights, for example, are so expensive, so they need the distribution to sort of – benefit that
they
cost.
Need the distribution, and I don't think NFL will be happy if after having sold the rights they whoever they sold it to was only put it in front of 5 million people instead of the whole country, right?
They couldn't afford it anyway. So
it's challenging, and it is concerning because I think the folks will test the waters and ultimately they'll figure out how far can they push it with regards to putting content on these direct to consumer platforms, and then they'll pull back and so on. I think the line is not clear yet, and they're trying to work that out.
So, and then with the local market, so like let's say in New York, if you're offering WNBC and WABC, et cetera, WNYW, are you guys going to each of the stations or each of the groups across local markets and negotiating retransmission consent deals just like you were cable operators?
Not usually. We have done that in the past for some markets, but usually the main broadcast networks will
just take a feed
that relationship. Yeah, okay. We usually will take a feed. Although, Well, I mean, taking a feed is probably an overstatement. The actual technical process for launching some of these channels locally that, you know, when we first got started, NBC asked us to launch pretty much all of their ONOs, and no one had launched their ONOs, and we had to figure out how we did that. We came up with some really creative solutions for that, but it's challenging on the technical side, but on the business side of things, I think they'll usually go and you know, introduce relationships, and we have a team here that primarily works on that.
So I'm in Denver. Let's say that I'm getting Fubo TV in Denver. Can I see like my local newscast, or do I go get that through an over-the-air antenna, or how does that work?
No, you can see it. You can see it. I mean, you can also get the antenna, but you can see it on Fubo, right? So if you're in Denver, you'll get the local stations from CBS, NBC, ABC, and the others, right? Actually, not ABC because we don't have Disney in the bundle, but the rest you will. And then on top of that, you'll get your regional sports networks, which for us has been of particular importance. We wanted to put the RSNs in our basic package because, again, we're prioritizing sports fans. So you'll get the local RSNs and you'll get your local stations all included.
Okay.
No
and
additional fees.
Has that transaction – I'm kind of going off the general line here, but has the – you know, when Fox got sold to Disney and then they had to divest the regional sports networks, and then I think they sold that to that investor group led by Sinclair. Has that made a difference to you guys, those kinds of transactions? Okay. How did that affect you?
Yeah, it makes a difference, right? So we had to redo our deals with Fox and so on, and then we had to make some decisions around carriage of these RSNs that are divested. And that's ongoing, right? So we're working through that right now. We care about sports, so we try to figure out how to make it work. At the same time, you have to create value to consumers, and that there is a line when you say, hey, maybe this is too costly or not, or, you know, you have to do the math and ultimately see if the value is there. The beautiful thing about our product is that we have direct data of consumption and engagement with programs and channels and so on. So we have a very clear sense of what any one network is worth to us in terms of dollars and percentage attribution to the network, to the bundle and so on. So we can make very educated decisions based on direct data about what the impact will be of having or not having certain pieces of programming on our kind of KPIs, if you will, engagement, retention, and so on. So that's really helpful. And the fact that, in the case that you just mentioned, we had the Fox RSNs and we still have them actually. But when we redo that deal, we'll have very clear sense of what it's worth to us, and the economics will follow from that.
Okay. And then let's talk a little bit about, you said you also have Fubo Hispanic or Fubo Latino?
Latino, yep.
But Latino. So it seems to me like that would be kind of a sweet spot for you guys. I don't think there's really
Yeah.
targeted Hispanic virtual MVPD. Is that
Not
true? No.
enough, not enough, not enough. Yeah, I mean,
Okay.
Sling has a Latino product as well. But look, I think the Hispanic market is super interesting because it's heavily underserved when it comes to, and I probably shouldn't say too much here because I'm sure some of our competitors are here.
Right.
But the Hispanic market, it's underserved in the U.S. And you're talking about an audience of 55 million plus Hispanics, right? Granted, a good portion of that, it's second and third generation Hispanics, which begin to behave more like general market. So they wouldn't be so much in the market for a Hispanic product. But that first and second generation Hispanic, it's in dire need of a product like ours, right? So we essentially have built a bundle that is super affordable, has most of what you need on the Hispanic side, very strong on the soccer side. We have every single Liga MX game on that bundle, which is the Mexican league, and we're marketing it, and we're doing phenomenal. Now, marketing to Hispanics is really challenging because even though you might be a first or second generation Hispanic, you're not necessarily consuming always content in English, in Spanish on the online. So finding Hispanics digitally in itself is a big challenge, but we're doing a pretty good job at it, I think.
Why is that so challenging?
Well, I'll give you a personal example. So my mom is, she's Cuban, and so am I, and she will speak Spanish at home all the time. But when it comes to doing a search online, she'll only search in English, and it's the most counterintuitive thing because she's Hispanic. She's the perfect audience for this product. But my ability to find her online as a consumer that is looking for a product like this is challenged by the fact that her search queries aren't in English. So if we just do very basic targeting, like language settings in your browser, like her computer is all set to English, so that will fail. And then if we looked at, okay, are you searching for content in Spanish? Then that would also fail because she's not. So how do I identify a Hispanic online? And then you could always say, oh, let's utilize third-party data from, the Acxiom of the world, and try to layer in these cohorts on our campaigns. And for the most part, that's actually pretty bad. It doesn't work efficiently. So you have to get creative, right? And then you might say, okay, well, can we run display campaigns on Spanish language websites? Well, at the same time, you'll see that a lot of these Hispanics are not, again, they're not going to these Spanish language websites. And there's a reason for why most of the traffic of these Spanish language websites, it's international, right? It's coming from Mexico, South America, Spain even. So you have to, and I won't tell you how we're doing it, but we have to get creative. We have to get creative in our ability to find Hispanics, because the traditional and kind of like the intuitive ways, oh, just target Spanish queries, they're not scalable, right? You have to find other ways.
That's interesting. So let's veer into that a little bit about the acquisition marketing that you guys are using to the degree that you can talk about it. When you launched Fubo TV, did you guys know that you would be using acquisition marketing, or is that something that has evolved along with the business?
No, we pretty much knew from day one that that was going to be all the marketing that we were doing. Like we can't afford to spend media dollars on branding or on branding. If you were to, I guess if you were to say the counterpart of acquisition marketing is brand marketing, we knew that that wasn't an area where we could play. And the reason why is because it's too expensive for us to be able
Right.
to make our name. So our idea was, listen, our strategy was going to be this. It's going to take a lot of dollars for us to create awareness about Fubo and then drive conversion to the service if we follow that route. Instead, our strategy became, how can we leverage the content that our partners have or that we're licensing basically, and utilize the demand and awareness for that content to raise awareness of our product, right? So it's kind of a second, like a flipped approach, if you will. Content first, brand second. And that early on strategy worked phenomenally because clearly there is demand for NFL, clearly there is demand for Champions League. And my job was essentially for to get the team to be able to tie the Fubo brand to all this premium content that people were searching for or actively trying to watch, right? And we did that. So from the very early days, our strategy was focused on user acquisition, looking at what content was marketable that had built-in demand, and how can we tie the brand for it, so that by maybe the second or third time that you're looking for that one game, you'll just think about Fubo and not necessarily think about doing a search, which will tell you where you can search for that or where you can watch that piece of programming, right? So that was the key. And
so wait a second. I mean, can you give an example of what that looked like? So let's say I wanted to watch a Champions League game, and so I do a search online, and then ads for Fubo TV pop up there, or does it also mean there's ads for Fubo TV within the games while they're streaming? Like, where do I find the marketing?
Yeah, so the former, right? So we like, if we were to put the ad in the game, it's more of an awareness play, and we have done it in the past. I mean, I think we experimented with a lot of different things. But if we were to put the ad in the game, there's an awareness play. If we were to capture intent, That's really where you're essentially leveraging the demand and built-in awareness of these programmings to drive acquisition of your business and to drive awareness of your brand, right? So we're definitely going to be capturing any kind of search queries that involve watching and any content that we have on the platform. So that's number one. That's easy. Number two, can I get smart about identifying someone who looks like the people that are buying my product based on their behavior, right? So if we can build a cohort of folks that are watching Champions League on Fubo, can we utilize lookalike targeting and things like that to find others that are potentially going to be interested in watching as well, right? So, but first and foremost, like, we're, if you, for example, if you look at maybe a lot of our competitors and the way that they do marketing, is brand first and then values secondary. And naturally, most of the values is usually in relation to cable, not necessarily in relation to watching or programming, right? Like they won't do a lot of event-driven marketing. In our case, it's content first. Like, hey, here's the Super Bowl. And by the way, it's on Fubo, right? You can watch it with Fubo. Mm-hmm. And that is far more efficient than from a capital expenditure point of view. And I don't think this is surprising. I'm sure everyone has figured out this playbook by now, just given what we're observing in the market. But in the early days, event-driven marketing was not a thing, and it was an edge when we were first getting started relative to the competition, because we were able to capture a lot of this intent, whereas the others were focused on, doing a branding campaign with Taylor Swift or something along those lines.
What would you say the ratio of your marketing is online or, in a purely acquisitional format versus doing anything? Like, would you ever go on NBC and advertise in a Premier League game? Like, hey, if you like Premier League, maybe you want to watch Champions League on Fubo.
Right. We've done it before. We've done two national TV campaigns. Our first one was with this gentleman called Fubo Chavez. And if you haven't seen the ads, I highly recommend that you YouTube it.
Okay.
Very controversial, and it was in itself a whole story. We can talk about it sometime. And then the second one was a whole campaign around Don't Compromise. And so to answer your question, most of our spend is acquisition driven digitally, but we will test the waters with non-DR or as quantitative and clearly driven efforts as digital. So we have done print, we have done offline billboards, we have done television, we've done radio. So all of these things we'll test. On a typical month, we'll take about 3% of our marketing budget and we'll invest it on experimentation. And every once in a while, there will be something unique that we test that turns this into its own user acquisition funnel, right? So we continuously do that. And TV and these channels continue to, I mean, even right now we're doing a TV campaign test. It's not a full-on campaign, but we're testing it regionally to see if we can make it perform somewhat in line with the performance that we're seeing digitally. So I guess to answer your question, primarily focus on digital direct acquisition. And it's only when we start to feel that we're not able to find scale in that category that we start going towards other maybe not so direct channels. But so far, we've been able to do a pretty good job of scaling digital.
So it's not a very large percentage of your marketing budget that goes toward that. But have you found when you've done it that it's effective, or how have you measured it?
Yeah, it's really hard to measure, frankly. But I think we did a pretty good job. We have a data science team internally, and let's talk about our first TV campaign. Most people will just say, hey, let's look at your baseline growth over your organic kind of predictable traffic. The challenge with that is that our traffic is super volatile. We don't have like a steady state traffic to our product. There's going to be a lot of volatility based on the content that we're broadcasting on the product. If there is kind of a marquee event, all of that is going to drive volume, right? So then because you don't have that kind of steady line of traffic, the impact of a TV campaign, it's hard to quantify because there is a lot of volatility and noise, right? So what we ended up doing is to take a kind of a narrow direct attribution approach to TV, and we said, okay, let's look at our post logs every time that a TV spot aired. And let's try to formulate a baseline traffic for the 15 minutes before the TV spot aired, the 15 minutes after it aired, and then the 15 minutes following that, you know, a total of 45 minutes, if you will. I'm doing a poor job explaining this, but you're looking at you know, pre-air, air, and then 15 minutes after that. What we say is, like, if there hadn't been a TV spot during this period of time, this is what we expect our traffic to be during those middle 15 minutes. But instead, we observed this behavior, right? So we attribute that lift, you know, under the curve, if you will, to the TV attributed subs. Now, so we did that. Now, okay, so now we have kind of a general pool of users, or let's say site traffic that was brought by the TV campaign by looking at a very narrow interpretation of the impact of TV spots just by that 15-minute window. So it doesn't take into consideration things like the long tail impact of TV, mm-hmm. or brand awareness or whatnot, or the secondary impact that it has on brand recognition and your kind of conversion rates and so on. We merely looked at it from a narrowed approach because we said, hey, if we want to evaluate this, we got to do it conservatively, and you know, the rest is kind of like the cherry on the top, if you will. So mm-hmm. we looked at it that way, and then on top of that, we said, because we have all this volatility, like if we have an NFL game right now, our site traffic is going to spike drastically. So how do we know that if there happened to be a TV spot during that period, that site, how much of that spike was driven by the TV spot versus just what we naturally observed for NFL? So for those particular instances, we ended up narrowing our attribution gap even further. So we now looked at 5 minutes instead of 15 minutes in order to evaluate the lift. So anyways, we do all that. We aggregate the data for every single spot that we run. We looked at the average conversion rates for those 15 minutes from visit to the website to a trial start. And we apply that to our post log data. And ultimately, we can come up with a subscriber acquisition cost because we know what we paid for each one of those spots, right? So that was our kind of like best attempt at figuring. So that was methodology number one. That was our best attempt at figuring out what the impact of TV was. The second methodology, which was probably less scientific, but probably worked as well, is, you know, we surveyed folks before our TV campaign run. And let's say you did a free trial today, and I ask you, hey, how did you first hear about Fubo? And, you know, we'll give you a bunch of options. Hey, I did a search on Google. I saw it on a website. I saw it on TV. Okay. So we got our baseline. And surprisingly, even though we had never run a TV spot before, something like 6% of users were saying, I saw it on TV. Which are like, okay, that's interesting. I wonder who's running ads on our behalf. So that's great. After the TV campaign aired, we went back to the cohort of people that came in during that period, and we asked the same question. How did you first hear about Fubo? And then we saw the lift. So now it went to, let's say, 15 to 17%. Okay, so then I'm ultimately attributing the spread between that initial 6% to that 17% and saying, okay, so this was brought by television. And that percentage, I will take it and apply it to the number of trials I gave during that period. And I'll take those trials divided by the expenditure on television, and thereby I have a trial acquisition cost. And then I'll apply my conversion rate, and then I'll have a subscriber acquisition cost for television. So that was our cycle methodology. And actually, the numbers were relatively close between the more scientific one that looked at the post logs and then the survey-based one that looked at the before and after.
Oh, that's
But
interesting.
it's really hard. TV attribution is tough.
Right. But then, so do you find that when you're marketing and you're looking at subscriber acquisition costs, that it still makes more sense to rely on the data that you're getting from your digital efforts versus the sort of, I don't know, voodoo
100%.
of the TV. Okay. So then when you do the
Yeah,
when you look at all
100.
the analytics for the data or for the digital, do you find that that's actually pretty precise?
It depends on it depends on your comfort level with certain attributions, right? So let's
Okay.
say a Facebook ad, right? If you see a Facebook ad today, I mean, let me ask you the question. You see a Facebook ad today for Fubo, and then 28 days later, you sign up for Fubo, but you never, this is clear, you never clicked on that Facebook ad. You just saw it. And
Okay.
then let's say 20 days later, you converted to Fubo. Is it really fair to say that that ad had an impact on your conversion, even though you didn't click on it? It's arguable, right? It's arguable because it's been so long since you saw that ad, and think about how many hundreds of ads you might see on Facebook. 28 days later, and so the default attribution window for Facebook is, you'll have click-through conversions and you have view-through conversions. And if you're looking at it at a high level, you'll say, "Oh, I'm crushing it on Facebook." The thing is that they're putting your ad in front of so many people that unless you get narrower about your attribution, then you're gonna have misleading data, right? So you have to be very careful about how you attribute conversions digitally. So in our case, we're saying, all right, if you click the Facebook ad for the next 28 days, because you clicked on it and you went to our landing page and you might have spent some time there learning about Fubo, I'm gonna give you that. I'm gonna say that's credit given. Listen, look, I'm not comfortable that it happened so long after that, but I feel okay about that premise. If you saw an ad and you didn't click on it, that's a different story. I'm not gonna give you credit for a person that clicked on it, that saw an ad and then 20 days later converted to our product. That doesn't make sense to me logically, right? I know as a consumer, I wouldn't like that. My a Facebook ad impression, the influence that has on a 28 day later behavior, it's probably small. But that we're conservative from that point of view. What we'll do is we'll say, okay, maybe not 28 days, but what about one day? What about 24 hours? If you see a Facebook ad today, you don't click it, but you buy my product today, is that fair? Is that a legitimate conversion? I think that's more legitimate, at least. Maybe I'm not 100% comfortable, but I think it's better than the alternative, right? So, to answer your question about are we 100% like comfortable with our spend digitally, and I mean, you have to kind of you still there's still a lot room for interpretation, right? And then think about multi-touch attribution. Okay, so I saw a Facebook ad, then I did a search on Google, and then I converted on Google. And who gets the credit? Google or Facebook? And frankly, there's not many tools that are very good about understanding that relationship. There are plenty of tools that are good at understanding that relationship when a click is involved, but not when an impression is involved. If you see a Facebook ad, Google or no tool, there's only one tool in the market that I know of that will track or has access to Facebook impression data, but pretty much everything else is based on click behavior. So if I put my ad in front of you on Facebook and you see it, and then you do a search on Google and you convert on Google, they're both taking the credit, and there isn't a clear link or relationship that we can understand. So even digital, I mean, TV is hard, but even digital is kind of up for interpretation. And then even within on a click basis, you have to think about how do we properly attribute a click during different periods of time, right? So if I click now and then I click again in 28 days later on two different campaigns, which campaigns gets the credit for that conversion? And then you can come up with different attribution models. Maybe it's binodal, so it's the first interaction and the last interaction. Maybe it is time decaying, where listen, it's the most reasonable one that counts the most, but I'm still gonna give some credit to the old ones and so on. So a lot of this is up for interpretation. But at the end of the day, it comes down to, are you hitting your subscriber acquisition cost goals, and are you getting those subscribers for a reasonable cost when you put it all together?
It's interesting though, because there's that space in the middle where you're sort of asking the analytics to be able to determine why a consumer made a decision when and how she or he did. And I don't know that there's a tool that can,
Yeah.
like send waves into the consumer's brains to be like, this was the moment that they decided to buy it.
I know, right? I mean, consumers don't know. I mean, like I said, like we had people saying they saw us on TV, and we had never run a TV campaign. So
Right, exactly.
you gotta take that with a leap of faith into how aware consumers are and how good their memory is about what led to a certain interaction. Maybe it was that a friend told them about it, but they ended up doing a search and then they converted on search. And when you survey the consumer, they're gonna say, oh, well, I don't know, one or the other. I heard it from a friend, or I did a search. But they might not necessarily indicate that both scenarios had an input in their decision-making process. So it's challenging. Attribution is really hard.
Yeah. Do you feel like some of your marketing still has to go to explaining to people and educating people on what Fubo is?
Oh yeah,
He
and it is
says with a big
unfortunate, right?
sigh.
Like, oh yeah. If I was selling a phone service, it'd be pretty easy because I would say, hey, it's a phone. Pick it up and you call people from it, and now you can install apps on it. You get it. But when you're talking about an industry that has only been around for 5 years, there's some educating to do. Like when we started out, we realized like consumers, they don't necessarily know. Because the category is new, for example, they wouldn't know if, oh, do I have to wait for someone to install a cable box for me to watch this game? So let's say that I was advertising the Super Bowl. Watch the Super Bowl right now with Fubo TV on NBC or whatever it is. And I had to take the extra step to say, and watch online right now, because that understanding was not clear, right? And even among the early adopters that are kind of a little bit more tech savvy than the folks that will cut the cord later, you still had to explain. And when you listen to some of these customer care calls, oftentimes consumers are not necessarily aware of a lot of the value and functionalities that the product offers. So you have to really make it so simple and so easy. So one of the things that we did in order to remove kind of assumptions or questions about how the product works is we built this type of landing page that has a live preview of the content that we're marketing. So picture this, you're trying to watch the Olympics. You search, how do I watch the Olympics right now? You click on a search ad, and that search ad brings you to a Fubo TV landing page. And in that Fubo TV landing page, you see a live preview of that event that you're looking for. It's literally playing live on an unauthenticated basis for 30 to 45 seconds on this page. So when you get there, and this is actually technology that we patented because no one had done this, we thought when you get there, we thought how can we remove the assumptions about how will I watch this? Do I need a device? How complicated is it? No, it's like don't worry about any of that. I'm showing it to you right now. Look at it. It's there. It's beautiful. It's playing. Look at the quality. It's amazing. And then after you experience it for 30 to 45 seconds, then I bring in a card at the end and say, continue watching, start your free trial, right? So I already taught you so much by simply showing you the video. I know it works. I know the quality is great. I know it's live. So I know I don't have to wait for someone to install some special software on my computer or bring me a Roku or a cable box. So there is educating that has to be done always, but we try to do that in creative ways. Like I could have also had a landing page that had a checklist that said, no cable box required, no contracts. No, I mean, we'll try those things. But it's a lot better when you just show the value and you just show the experience.
On something like the Olympics, for example, which I guess are coming up in June, do you work with your content partners in terms of, like, let's say you have deals with NBC and you're like, the Olympics is coming up. Do you use that as a marketing tool for Fubo?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. So for pretty much every major event, we always team up with the marketing teams at each one of the distributors, or rather the broadcast stations or whoever it is that has the content.
So,
And
like, let's say, like,
we try to
FIFA
get
World
creative.
Cup this summer, the Women's World Cup, would that be something that you worked with, like,
Yeah.
Fox Sports on? Okay.
Yeah. For sure. For sure. So we go there, we explain our playbook, and we say, hey, here's everything we could be doing. And then we'll usually bring like one or two crazy ideas that will make people uncomfortable and say, what if we try this? People like traditional and predictable things, but every once in a while, you have to bring in some fresh blood. So we'll come up with one of those, and often we'll get it through. I mean, this live preview idea was actually one that we had to do a lot of fighting for because, folks were uncomfortable with it. It's like, oh, you're telling me you're going to put the live feed on an unauthenticated basis? And, you know, we had to do a lot of educating and saying, hey, this is innovation in marketing, and this is how we're going to get this industry to grow by removing assumptions and so on. So yeah, absolutely, we'll work with each one of the stations, and we'll, you know, their marketing teams will have unique ideas, and they know the content better than anyone else. So they'll tell you, here's a rising star, or here's a story that is unique. But, you know, I think the challenge that we've had is that often the marketing teams at some of these companies are brand centric, right? They're thinking about, hey, this is an iconic event, and you know, they're thinking about it from more of a holistic level. Whereas for us, it's like, we care about what users will do. And which is that we want them to subscribe. So we have to think about it from those lens. So how can we utilize this event to be a driver of user acquisition and to be a driver of retention, right? Which is as important.
So, okay. And then as you, like 5 years ago when you were getting started versus now, was it hard to get those marketing teams to work with you on that? I know that's something that they would definitely do.
Yeah.
You know, they have whole affiliate teams that would do that with their cable operator partners. But for you guys, were they like, who are you? Why would we work with you on this?
Well, you know, the hardest part was the licensing. Right. Once we had the deal done, then, hey, we're paying top dollar for this, so work
okay.
with us. And you know, the teams are generally amicable. I think it was probably harder for us to build a marketing team in those early days, not necessarily work with third-party marketing teams. Like, we built all of our marketing is done in-house, right? So we don't rely on agencies to do core executions for us, only in areas that we don't have an expertise on, like, let's say, creative for our TV campaign. It's one where we'll work with a third-party agency. But for the most part, we built a team. You know, the whole marketing group is in-house, and building a team that can really deliver on marketing in a world where so much time, especially in our industry, is spent on kind of fluffy metrics around engagement or likes and whatnot and brand awareness. You know, it was actually very challenging, and I'm really happy because I think we have a top-notch marketing team here. And by the way, we're hiring, so if anyone listening wants a job at Fubo.
Okay, put that out there. Okay, we're getting to the end, but, you know, obviously something that's happening now is we've seen Apple TV Plus come online and Disney Plus. Those are not, in my opinion, your direct competitors, but what has the arrival of those services and the pending arrival of HBO Max and Peacock and Quibi, what does that mean to you guys?
I mean, as you point out, I'm not worried about those services, and I think that they curate and they cater their service to a portion of the market that doesn't necessarily overlap in terms of time allocation with ours, right? So we're focused on sports streaming, live television, news, and these are obviously areas that these services do not have, right? So
mm-hmm.
when I think about a Netflix or a Disney Plus, I think clearly, they'll do very well. I think Disney Plus is it's impressive to see kind of the early growth that they are seeing, you know, on the back of you know, a lot of it being kind of archive content, and some of the really good new shows that they're releasing. But for us, I'm not worried because it's a very different category. We're really focused on the folks that are paying for cable, that
mm-hmm.
are sticking with cable because they get live sports and because
mm-hmm.
they get news.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an area that will continue to exist, right? Like, I don't see that going to Netflix anytime soon.
Well, in a way, I feel like those kinds of services are actually additive. You know, like, that's actually, like, look, you can have Fubo and then you can
yeah.
add on whatever it is you want.
Yeah.
It's almost like a bonus.
I know, right? Yeah. I mean, I think the challenge is when how many services is too many, right?
Yeah.
If you think about it, you have NBC, CBS, Peacock, you know, yeah. I think for consumers, you think about how much it's spent in even just creating awareness of all these services, and consumers are just starting to be overwhelmed because, hey, you know, this one particular show, where do I watch it? Am I going to see it on, is it on Netflix? Is it on Hulu? Is it on the other guy? So it's actually challenging. And, you know, I think probably in 5 years from now, there's not going to be nearly as many services. I think the market will probably consolidate, and some of these folks will not afford to continue to burn billions of dollars to build brands that have that consumers have minimal loyalty towards because they're loyal to content. And we'll see. But for now, it's pretty confusing, I think.
I'm going to leave it there. But thank you so much, Alberto. I appreciate your time. I find all the acquisition
awesome.
Marketing stuff totally fascinating. I sort of understand it. I'm learning about it, but I think it's really interesting. So thank you for sharing some time
really
with
cool.
us today.
Thanks for giving me a chance. It's a pleasure,
okay.
Paige.
Pleasure too, and we'll talk soon.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye. Paige Albaniak is Editorial Director of Promax. Andres Trujillo, Promax's social media and community manager, produced this podcast. Video Helper provides the music. Digital content producer Kayla Marie Hardaway contributes to Daily Brief. Promax is rebranded to just Promax, so you can find us on Promax Global on Facebook and Promax_Global on Twitter and Instagram. You can also always reach out to us at dailybrief@promax.org, and you can subscribe to the Daily Brief podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening.